From Iowa Public Radio, this is Under the Golden Dome, a weekly podcast about the legislative session that is closer to adjourning for the year. I'm John Pimple. Because the end is near, leaders are being asked quick questions about what is going forward and what isn't.
Let's do a lightning round, yes or no, to these questions, if you will.
That's dangerous.
Last week on Iowa Public Television's political show, Iowa Press, panelist Kay Henderson from Radio Iowa asks Senate President Jack Whitfer about a bill that would change how water utilities in larger cities operate.
Will the Iowa legislature dismantle the Des Moines Water Works?
No.
Had the bill passed, the effect for the Des Moines Water Works would result in handing over control of the independent utilities, $250 million in assets, to a new board. The Water Works general manager says the legislation is retaliation aimed at the Des Moines utility because it filed a lawsuit against three agriculture drainage districts. After the suit was dismissed by a federal judge, the House bill stalled. It doesn't mean a bill like this won't return in the future, but for now, it is gone. Medical marijuana, however, is now back in the legislative game.
My name is Carrie Anderson. I'm a Grimes resident, and I'm a person living with MS. I can't believe we're here, so I'm a little taken back.
Carrie Anderson is an advocate for medical marijuana, and she tells senators during an appropriations subcommittee this week what she goes through to help treat multiple sclerosis.
In 7 years, my family has battled all things MS, from nightly shots, failed medications, AM, afternoon, and PM medication dispensers, indescribable fatigue, vision loss, incontinence, to well over a dozen hospital stays, three extended stays in rehabilitation centers, learning to walk all over again, to teaching my 10-year-old son how to explain to his friends that his mommy's legs don't work like their mommy's do.
Anderson says some of the many drugs she takes make her sick, and she believes medical marijuana may be a solution.
For some of the nearly 5,000 Iowans living with MS, medical cannabis could be their one. You see, when you live with a chronic disease, you look for any flicker of hope. You hold on to it with all of your might, looking for ways to live your best possible life. I'm not here to say that medical cannabis is for me or for anyone else. I am here to say it should be an allowable option for our medical teams.
Others share their experiences of medical conditions that could be helped by marijuana. The bill requires a patient to register for a medical cannabis card to be issued by the Department of Transportation. Some of the many requirements include a written certification by a healthcare practitioner. The card would cost $100 or $25 for someone enrolled in a medical assistance program. Authors of the bill are Senators Bolcom, Green, Zahn, and Schneider. Senator Schneider says he wants this to be a law, not a statement bill.
This is something that we would like to be able to get through the House and down to the governor's desk.
The senator says the bill is designed for medicinal, not recreational use of marijuana.
And that's why we have some of the things in here that we do, like the requirement of a registration card, which would have a photo ID of the person who's getting the product. And the strict requirements on the number of manufacturers and dispensaries.
The bill says no fewer than 4 and no more than 12 cannabis manufacturers will be allowed in Iowa, and that there are to be 12 dispensaries.
The other consideration that we want to keep in mind is that with a small overall state population relative to other states, we need to make sure that we're providing enough consumer demand to make it worthwhile for a manufacturer to want to come into the state to produce the product. For that reason, we're starting out with a much more extensive range of conditions that apply for or that can qualify for medical cannabis than certainly what's under our existing law and some of the other things that have been considered in the past.
Those conditions identified in the bill to receive medical marijuana as part of a treatment are cancer, multiple sclerosis, epilepsy, AIDS, glaucoma, hepatitis C, Crohn's disease, Lou Gehrig's disease, Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, post-traumatic stress disorder, Tourette's syndrome, intractable pain, Parkinson's disease, muscular dystrophy, Huntington's disease, Alzheimer's disease, complex regional pain syndrome type 1 and 2, rheumatoid arthritis, any terminal illness with a probable life expectancy of less than 1 year if the illness or its treatment produces one or more of the following: intractable pain, nausea, severe wasting, or any other chronic or debilitating disease or medical condition or its medical treatment approved by the Department of Public Health. This bill passes the subcommittee, then a committee, and so now it's eligible for debate on the Senate floor. But even if it passes the Senate, Representative Clell Bodler says,
3 days after hell freezes over, that bill will pass in the House.
House Speaker Linda Uppmeyer also says this bill would be voted down in the House of Representatives. Another bill that probably can't pass in the House, this time due to a technical reason, is about sanctuary cities. But it isn't stopping the Senate from bringing it up. The definition of what a sanctuary city is, mostly it's a city or county that makes policy not to assist federal law enforcement when it comes to questioning a person's citizenship that may result in them being deported. President Donald Trump signed an executive order in January to deny federal funding to jurisdictions that pass such rules. In Iowa, the Senate's version of this rule would deny state funding to a sanctuary city. Earlier this year, the Iowa City Council approved a resolution that none of their resources can be used toward enforcing federal immigration law. Part of Iowa City's resolution says the power to regulate immigration is exclusive to the federal government. On Wednesday night, Senate File 481, one that would deny funding to sanctuary cities in the state, is called up, but first, a point of order.
Chair recognizes Senator from Lynn, Senator Hoag.
I just want to renew my earlier objection.
Yep. Earlier when Senator Dix called up Senate File 481, Senator Hoag raised a point of order and objected under Joint Rule 20. After analyzing both Joint Rule 20 and the bill history for Senate File 481, Senator Hoag's point is not well taken. It is clear that Senate File 481 is eligible for debate in the Senate as it was first reported out of a standing committee by Friday of the eighth week and subsequently placed on the unfinished business calendar.
Senate President Jack Whitfer, who is about to be referred to as the chair, is saying the bill made it through the funnel. The deadline a bill has to go through to be eligible for debate, but Senator Hoag isn't having it.
Mr. President, I would move to challenge the ruling of the chair. This is an unprecedented violation of the joint rules because this legislation did not survive the second funnel and is not attached to any House file and therefore is no longer eligible for consideration in the 2017 legislative session. And I would ask for a record roll call on that challenge.
The senator from Lynn has moved to challenge the ruling of the chair that the bill is eligible for debate. A record, his challenge that it is not eligible for debate. The record roll call vote has been requested. The secretary will open the voting system and receive your vote.
This is not the usual process in any chamber, but it can happen. Senate President Jack Whitfer clarifies what the body is voting on.
Just for the information of the body, a yes vote would overrule my ruling that the bill is eligible for debate. A no vote would sustain my ruling that it is eligible for debate.
The results, aye 20, no 27. The motion to challenge the ruling of President Whitfer fails. The bill is eligible for debate in the Senate. Senator Julian Garrett is the floor manager and gives the opening remarks.
Sanctuary cities may be cities or they may be counties. And you've probably been reading about this issue. It's an issue both nationally and here in Iowa. And where it comes from is the federal government has an agency that's in charge of immigration and dealing with people who are in the country illegally, primarily through what we call ICE, the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency. And how this issue arises is when ICE believes that someone who is in custody, who's been arrested, maybe even convicted of a crime, who's in custody with a local governmental agency, is in the country illegally and is subject to deportation. So they issue what's called a detainer, a request to the local entity to turn the individual over to ICE rather than releasing them. And the vast majority of local law enforcement folks comply with the request. They cooperate with the federal authorities. But there are a few that don't. And there are, unfortunately, a few in Iowa that don't, although, again, the vast majority of Iowa counties and cities do cooperate, and there's no problem with the big majority of them.
There are 10 sections to this bill, but the most significant is the ninth.
The Section 9 directs the Department of Management to adopt rules to ensure that state funds are denied uniformly. There's a provision for denying state funds to entities that intentionally violate the provision. And I want to point out the intention of that is not to withhold state funds, but it's to create a sanction that is serious enough so that the local entities will comply with the law. That's what we are, that's what the aim of the bill is. And I'm confident that when this bill is passed, that that will be the case. I can't imagine that local law enforcement would not comply with the state law in this regard.
Senator McCoy says the bill is horrible legislation.
You've drug it out. Procedurally, you've failed to meet the deadlines that were required of you. We had a comprehensive committee hearing on this. You adopted two amendments, and then you went back to work and changed a few things, and then you bring this out in the 11th hour. Nobody's had time to think about this. Nobody's had time to work on this. And again, it is a postcard bill. It is a political postcard bill. This will be used as a political postcard by the Republicans against Democrats.
Senator McCoy calls it a postcard bill because he doesn't think it can be debated in the House.
I don't think it'll become law. In fact, I know it won't become law this year. You're going to send it over to the House. It's not going to be taken up. It's dead legislation. It's dead for the year. I think you should be ashamed of yourself for bringing it to the floor in this content.
During a record roll call vote for an amendment, something unusual happens. Senator Rich Taylor states he will not participate in the vote, and there is a rule how he can withhold voting while remaining in the chamber. President Whitfer explains.
You should vote aye or no unless the senator states a personal interest in the question or concludes that he or she should not vote under the Senate Code of Ethics. You want to state your point?
Yes, this is a violation of the Code of Ethics that I took at the beginning of this session on January 9th. This is a violation of the Senate rules, the joint rules with the House, and I refused to vote on that premises.
As senators make their final remarks, something unusual happens. This is like the third time during this story I've said something unusual happens, but believe me, this is very unusual. It happens as Senator Herman Kornbach speaks.
It requires us to defend the right of speech, the right to speak the most vile and hateful speech imaginable.
The emergency system is activated.
The Senate will stand at ease for the emergency.
A recorded message beams through the entire Capitol building declaring an emergency has been reported. At 8:45 Wednesday night, senators evacuate the chamber before the all clear is sounded. After the room is empty, the alarm continues to blare for 14 minutes. I know this because we have every single cycling of the electronic siren recorded. In a way, it's kind of eerie to hear the chamber emptied out. The senators come back, a quorum is called, and debate resumes for 20 minutes until the bill passes, 32 yes, 15 noes. All Republicans vote for it, as do four Democrats. This is Under the Golden Dome, a weekly podcast about the legislative session. It's important to note most bills that pass do not have a heated debate. One bill, House File 579, is an example of legislation that gains approval of everyone in the chamber with a yes vote. It will modify criminal penalties. In some cases, a sentencing will be lighter, and others, harder. On March 20th, Representative Zach Nunn delivers the opening remarks.
What House File 579 attempts to do is recognize safe, smart, and cost-effective ways at justice reform within Iowa. Currently, Iowa's prison population is at 114% of capacity, housing far too many drug offenders, those first-time nonviolent offenders who have come forward for a drug offense and are now serving mandatory prison sentences of up to 5 years in Iowa's prison. This is expensive. In fiscal year 17 alone, the Department of Corrections estimated that it was $387 million out of the general fund. What we are attempting to do by justice reform in this aspect is to look at what the cost it is to put a mandatory sentence on a first-time nonviolent offender in prison at a cost of $95.85 a day and move them into a parole or rehab program for as little as $4.59 per day. With Iowa's continuing to grow prison population, the 388 plus individuals who fall into this category could save Iowa hundreds of thousands of dollars if smarter sentencing reform were to put in place.
After a few representatives speak in support, the bill passes 97-0. It has yet to come before the Senate. This week, Iowa Public Radio's talk show River to River hosts a conversation with Representative Zach Nunn and Representative Mary Wolf in the Capitol's Law Library to discuss the bill. The show is hosted by Joyce Russell and Ben Kiefer.
What's your reaction, Representative Nunn, to how we got here, when and why there were standards placed for mandatory minimums and to get tough on crime? What was he thinking?
Well, back in the 1990s when they first came out, I probably would have still been in junior high school. But the aspect here is that there was a number of criminals being identified as drug offenses that were getting very disparate sentences from justices in different areas. So you might have a rural judge who convicted someone and held them to a very high threshold. And then you had an urban judge who had someone at a very low threshold. They both end up in the same sentencing program, and they're not getting equal treatment under the law. I think we've come a long ways since then. We've identified that standard sentencing really affords the judge to be able to look at each case individually and identify if there's a certain threshold that's been met. I want to be very clear that in this bill, House File 579, that it wouldn't be for all drug offenders. We're talking about nonviolent first-time drug offenders who would fall under here. But the most serious offenses, those who are doing distribution, those who have a high intensity of distribution or are repeat offenders, are not going to fall into this category. At the same time, we're keeping Iowans safe while increasing fairness. It allows the courts to ensure the mandatory minimum sentences are not misapplied to less dangerous and less deserving offenders. And perhaps most importantly, we've had a number of states who have already proven this, those from both red states and blue states, Oklahoma and Maryland being two recent examples, where this type of individualized, standardized sentencing really affords the judge better discretion and is shown to get people back into the community in a productive way. Representative Wolf brings up a key point here. There's also got to be the investment on the follow-on side, the reintroduction into society. But again, that's at a fraction of the price of keeping somebody in prison for a much longer time, where they're more likely to come out as a worse offender than they were going in.
Representative Nunn, I know you haven't been in the legislature that long, but I assume you've been a Republican for a while. Can you pinpoint, it wouldn't have been that many years ago, when it would have been very unusual for Republicans to take this risk of looking soft on crime. Can you put your finger on a time when that tide started to turn?
Yeah, I think that when we've looked at a number of issues, this bill, again, I don't want anyone to walk away from this thinking that we're soft on crime here. This is still going to be a smart on crime, tough on crime approach. In fact, we put a couple of things in there that would really look at if somebody was in violation of their parole, they went out and reoffended in drug. We have snap sentencing, which means they come right back into the system so that it's not a blank check. You don't have to be reconvicted again. I think that as Republicans and as Democrats have looked across the board, what's truly working, it's an evolving process. We certainly don't have 1950-style sentencing anymore here in Iowa or anywhere in the country. We're moving that way smartly. And I think there's better ways now with technology, too, that affords us to watch a person on parole and provide some of the resources that may not have been there even as recently as 10 years ago.
And Representative Wolf, I know from our earlier conversation that while you support this legislation, you might have made an argument that it's pretty limited. Could you talk about your feeling that maybe this isn't, it's not going to apply to that many people, and you have some ideas on how it could have been tougher or could have been affected more people?
Right. I think maybe a more comprehensive bill. I think this is, again, as far as drug offenses are concerned, I think that this is it's smart sentencing reform. It is evidence-based. The standard sentencing provision would, I believe, allow a judge to sentence any drug offender to a non-mandatory, you know, to something other than prison, but only under certain very definite parameters, and I'm sure a judge wouldn't do that for a first offense. It does. The bill that we passed out of the House would have also allowed some discretion, that judges to use some discretion, have some flexibility on a few of what are called forcible felonies, for example, robbery second. Again, there's hundreds of people serving sentences for robbery second that have been identified as very low risk to reoffend, but who are sitting in prison for 7.5 years before they're eligible for parole and then are discharged and have a very short time of parole supervision. So my hope is that once, you know, now that we've done this, and I hope it will be successful, and we will see both a drop in the amount of money we spend on prisons and then also on the recidivism rate, I'm hoping that we can come back next session and maybe take a good look at, you know, sentencing reform with regard to forcible felonies. There's all sorts of evidence showing that if it's done right, it really does. It would make Iowa a safer place to live, and it would save us millions of dollars. So,
and the forcible felony provision that you just mentioned that's in the House bill, I understand, am I correct, that there's a Senate amendment to take that out?
Well, there's a Senate amendment that specifically designates robbery second as being one of the long, long list of offenses that are not eligible to receive a standard sentence, or I think the Senate calls it an alternative sentence. So, to be honest, now under the bill, there's basically no forcible felony for which this sentencing reform bill applies anymore. It is just pretty much strictly drug offenses. But again, it's there, the framework is there, and I hope that we can look at it again next session.
And the drug offenses that the bill does cover, these are relatively small sentences to begin with, right?
Well, a lot of the mandatory minimums for drug offenses, courts already had some discretion to waive them under a lot of circumstances. However, still, they do add up, and they are pretty irrational to put someone in there and say, well, you have to sit 2 years. What's the point of that if you don't give them any treatment? So obviously, this will have a impact on our prison population, and it will have a good fiscal impact. And so I just hope that we can do something a little more comprehensive in the future.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, what can either of you say about the degree of support this has and the chances that this will reach the governor's desk in one form or another?
Yeah, I was really proud of the House. I was proud of them last year when we passed a sentencing reform bill, and I was disappointed when it went over the Senate and they stripped out some of the provisions of that. And the Senate this time around has already kind of restricted the bill. They filed an amendment that restricts it, and I am concerned that they won't move it at all, which would be really disappointing because there is all sorts of evidence-based research that just absolutely documents the fact that doing what this bill proposes reduces crime, reduces recidivism, and saves money. And so unless and until the Senate is willing to take a look at that research and govern themselves accordingly and do what's best for the state, that bill's sitting over in the Senate. So I have faith that they do want to do what's best for everyone involved. And so I'm hoping that it still moves forward, ends up on the governor's desk.
Representative Nunn, do you have similar concerns?
Yeah, Ben, one of the things about this bill is that we pass it 97-0 in the House. It is very rare that a bill as comprehensive as this gets that level of bipartisan support. And it's a huge credit to both Representative Wolf and Olson, who helped move smart amendments onto it. At the same time, it's not just here in Iowa. We have groups as diverse as Families Against Mandatory Minimums, liberal think tanks on our street who are advocating for this bill, while at the same time, Grover Norquist with Tax Relief and the American Conservative Union are all very much in support of this. So for these, it's like a solar eclipse in the same 24-hour period. It is very rare that we get this opportunity, and I'd really like to be able to see movement in the Senate. We've been working with our colleagues there to identify, hey, there are probably some revisions that could be made, but we still need to get this down to the governor's desk. And it's good for the individual, it's good for the community, and it's good for the taxpayer.
Representative Nunn, there's another part of this bill that we haven't talked about that is the result of the tragic shooting deaths of two Des Moines area police officers last year. Tell us about that part of the bill.
Right. I think this is a really important part of the bill. And when we talk about being smart on crime, it also means not just the rights of the offender or the community, but those who are running into harm's way. And far too often, this is the peace officer in Iowa. What this would allow, we had an officer from my community who was targeted and killed this summer. His family lives in my area, and the challenge is that if you kill a law enforcement officer, you will spend the rest of your life in prison if convicted. The challenge is that if you shoot an officer and their vest protects and saves their life, you may only be in for a Class B. And after 70% of your sentence, because Iowa is good about time earned, you may see someone who tries with intent to kill an officer out walking on the street after they've served good time in prison. I think that sends the wrong message to people who would do harm to the vanguard of who's trying to keep our community safe. So this is really a testament to our law enforcement officers are the ones who are responding to some of the most dangerous events in Iowa and providing them that enhanced level of protection. And I believe truth in sentencing, that if you're going to try and kill an officer, you will spend 100% of your time in prison, whether you are a good shot or a bad shot, to put it in those blunt terms.
So this is a bill to reduce sentences, and that part of the bill goes in the other direction. Was there bipartisan support for that, Representative Wolf?
Well, the whole idea of enhancing penalties based on the identity of the victim is a little problematic, I think, for some of us, and that one could argue that a young child's life is also as valuable. I also think that there's the idea that this somehow gives law enforcement some protection that they wouldn't otherwise have. I think that's a little overly optimistic, and that I don't think people who are going to kill a police officer make that kind of cost-benefit analysis. Having said that, yes, certainly the fact that we link those two issues together, both the sentencing reform and then the 100% sentencing enhancement for that specific crime, it certainly did help move the bill out of the House unanimously. And again, I would think that that would also be appealing to our senators.
Representative Mary Wolf with Representative Zach Nunn. They are guests on River to River from the Capitol's Law Library, hosted by Joyce Russell and Ben Kiefer. This is Under the Golden Dome, a weekly podcast about the Iowa legislative session. As per normal, in the last month of a session, the governor is signing many bills into law. The majority of them are 100% bipartisan. That means they are passed with no opposing votes. He signed 26 bills with this kind of passage on Wednesday. But on Thursday, he signed a controversial piece of legislation, a bill that makes significant changes for the use and carrying of firearms.
I've always been a strong supporter of the Second Amendment, and this legislation makes Iowa one of the most pro-Second Amendment states in the country. Expanding the freedoms and solidifying the constitutional rights of Iowans should always be a goal for our state, whose motto is, our liberties we prize and our rights we will maintain.
After July 1st, a person will have the right to bring a concealed pistol to the Capitol, including the legislative chambers, if they have a permit.
Representative Winchittle has been working on this legislation for several years. Representative Winchittle, I know you worked closely with many stakeholder groups on this legislation, and you met with the Lieutenant Governor and I on a number of occasions.
Yes, sir.
And worked out issues and concerns that people had as we went through the process. So I want to thank you. These things don't happen by accident.
There are many aspects to this bill. Some are now effective, including no longer having the names and addresses of gun permit holders as part of public records. Also, children that are 14 years or younger can use a pistol if supervised by a parent as of Thursday. But the Stand Your Ground provisions take place July 1st. Some of the biggest and most contentious issues this year at the Capitol are the gun bill, collective bargaining, cutting spending this fiscal year, workers' compensation, abortion, voter ID. But many think the biggest and longest battle is yet to come, the budget for next year. This has the potential to delay the final adjournment by days, even weeks, if there is an impasse. The session is scheduled to end next week, or at least that's when the per diems stop. But in all of our informal discussions with lawmakers, nobody thinks the session will be over on April 18th. So where does that leave this show under the Golden Dome? There are some aspects of the budget proposals available now, but I want to wait for more to come out. So much can change, but by next week, we will have a better idea of what is moving through. On this podcast, we don't analyze everything. We don't run through all the major headlines. We do select a handful of stories with sound to give you an opportunity to sit at the Capitol as decisions are being made, or in some cases, ideas are floated around. Right now, our tentative plan is to make next week, week 15, our final episode, but maybe not. We just don't know what will happen next week. The problem with the session going into overtime, or potentially going into overtime, is there may or may not be a variety of issues to discuss, not just the budget. As with all things politics, it just depends. Who knows? Maybe we'll take a few weeks off and return with a final analysis of the budget bill if it doesn't pass until the end of the month. All I can say is keep this show subscribed and your podcast listening platform of choice. The concept for Under the Golden Dome comes from Catherine Perkins. Michael Leland, the news director, gives us editorial support. Stories for this show come from Joyce Russell, Clay Masters, Sarah Bowden, Katerina Sestarik, the talk show team with Ben Kiefer, Lindsay Mood, Emily Woodbury, and our many friends in the State House press pool. They are always helpful when discussing stories and helping us get facts straight. Big thanks to Kay Henderson from Radio Iowa for sharing unedited audio clips for us to include in this show. At least one more episode is coming. Week 15 of Under the Golden Dome will be released probably next Friday afternoon from iowapublicradio.org. I'm John Pimble.